the opening problem. Since the Winter Olympics just finished in BC, we thought we'd put up a problem that involves them. So we gave you a table of all the years that Canada's been in the Olympics and the number of medals they won in each year. So we asked you to find the mean, the median, and the mode of the number of medals Canada's won. And you could include the year 2010, where they won 26 medals, but we're gonna do it with and without. So the mean, right, which we know is the average of all the data. If we did it with without 2010, what do we get?
Six.
Six. That's right, six. So how did we do that?
You add all the number of medals, and then divide by the number of medals that there are.
Okay, so we added up all the medals, the number of medals, and divided by how many?
Numbers there, so there's
20. So, yeah, by the number of years that they were in the Olympics, and we can see that they were in the Olympics 20 times, right? So we divided by 20.
That's just weird how it works.
So, on average, over like the number of times Canada's been in the Olympics, they've won about 6 medals. So, how about with 2010? Approximately how many medals does Canada have on average? Yep. Yeah.
7.
It's about 6.95, but we're going to round, say 7. Because it's that close. How about the median? The middle number of all the data without 2010 included in our data set.
3.
Yeah, it's 3. The middle number of the data without 2010 is actually 3. So if you arrange all the number of medals that Canada won in increasing order, it's actually 3. How about with 2010? What do we get? 3? That's right, it's 3. So either way, with 2010 in the data and without 2010, the middle number is still 3. And how about the mode? 3. Without 2010, and how about with 2010? It's still 3. Because as we can see, as part of the data, Canada won 3 medals the most times. Today's lesson is data analysis. So we're going to be talking about scatter plots and lines of best fit. So when given a set of data, we can find out more information than just what we said, the central tendencies, the mean, median, mode, okay? There's more to be found out, and we're going to talk about that today. So we're going to define first a scatter plot, which is a graph consisting of a set of points that relate to different quantities. And the line of best fit. A line of best fit is exactly what it says. It is a straight line that best approximates the trend shown by a group of data points. And you usually draw the line of best fit in a scatter plot. So if you look in the picture, you have an example of a scatter plot and the line of best fit. So the entire thing with the axes lines and the points graphed on them is the scatter plot. And we can see that we're relating two quantities. What are those two quantities?
The time and the number of fish caught.
So we're relating the time with the number of fish caught. So over time, how many fish do you catch? Right, and those are vaguely plotted on this little example. And the line of best fit is drawn. That kind of approximates the trend, right? So we can see that the more time we spend on the lake, per se, naturally the more fish you think you're going to catch. And so that's an example of a scatter plot and a line of best fit. So I wrote out a list of helpful hints when drawing the line of best fit. You always want to use a ruler, so for those of you who have a ruler today, good for you. If not, a straight edge is fine. So, you know, if you have something that has a straight edge, like, you know, the edge of your paper, if you're very careful, you can draw a line of best with that. And it's better to have a transparent one. And you'll see why when we do examples. When you're drawing the line of best fit, you kind of want to pass through as many points as possible. If you don't pass through that many points, it's fine. It's just, you know, best to pass through a lot of points. And if you don't pass through all of the points, you want to try to have an equal number of points above and below the line, getting the line that best fits the data. And the fourth one is the most important. It's using your best judgment. Lines of best fits are drawn manually a lot of times. You can draw them on a computer as well. There's programs that do that. But when we're doing it right now, you're going to do it by hand. And you know what? There's, as it says in the note, there are many possible lines of best fit when drawing them by hand. You just have to, you know, look at the rules, use the rules. And you just want to draw the best one possible. So you guys might be wondering, why are we using a line of best fit? Why do we have to graph a line of best fit, right? And it's used to interpolate and extrapolate data. Interpolation is predicting a value from the scatter plot that is inside the range of your data. And extrapolation is predicting the value from the scatter plot that is outside the range of your data. And the range of your data is the difference between the greatest and the lowest value in the data set. And the line of best fit can help us do that. So we're going to do an example. Miss Crescent wanted to find some information on her students' most recent test. So she decided to ask the students how long they studied for the test, and then graph their hours studied against their mark on the test. And below is the scatter plot of the data that she found. So, like we said, a scatter plot is a graph consisting of a set of points that relate two quantities. So what are the two quantities being related in this example?
Marks and the hours studied.
Exactly. So you want to know how many hours they studied, and you can graph it against the marks that they have. Okay, so we're going to draw the line of best fit. So we can see, by using our rules, we want to try to get as many points on the line and above and below the line. And we're going to use our best judgment. So I have a bunch of points above the line, a bunch of points below the line, a couple points touching the line, and we kind of see that it fits the graph, right? So the first question, well, that was the first question, to draw the line of best fit. So B, using the line of best fit, estimate the mark a student could have gotten if she studied for 12 hours. Okay, so this is interpolation, right? Because we want to interpolate the data, because it's within our range. So, if you want to find the mark the student could have gotten, we draw a vertical line perpendicular to the 12-hour mark to the line of best fit. And we're going to draw a horizontal line to the vertical axis to determine an accurate mark. And we can see that if she studied, he or she studied for 12 hours, approximately what would their mark be on the test? Someone tell me?
90.
What else?
92.
92. Any other guesses? Yeah, we can see that the approximate mark is about 92, 93, 94-ish. Any one of those answers is correct, right? Because this is our line of best fit with our best judgment. So there's always room for a little bit of error. So we can see that they would get about a 93. And the second part, the mark a student would have gotten if he or she didn't study at all. So if he or she didn't study at all, how many hours did they study?
Zero.
So they studied for 0 hours. This is extrapolation because we don't have a value of a student studying for 0 hours, right? Our values start at about 1 and they go up to 13. So this is extrapolation. We're using the line of best fit, we're drawing it further, and we're going to see what mark the student would have gotten if they didn't study at all. So we can see here it's kind of easy. It's where the axis hits the zero mark, and what approximate mark is that?
35.
35? Zero. They would have gotten the mark of zero? Well, if you use the line of best fit, what did it look like? 32. Any other guesses? Yeah? 32?
34.
34-ish. 33. So it's around 33, 34, 35, approximately. So if they didn't study at all, you might have had a little bit of knowledge, you know, from the class, because a little bit from the class, and they managed to get a mark of 34. So the last part of the question, what appears to be the relationship between the number of hours studied and the mark earned? So now looking at the answer, what can you guys tell?
The higher the amount of time you studied, the higher your marks.
Exactly, the higher,
the longer
you study, the higher your mark, which is exactly what the trend shows.
But how does somebody study for, like, 11 and a half hours, and they, like, totally smoke the test for, like, 98?
Yeah, see, that it varies, right? Data varies. Right? So someone could have studied for a shorter amount of time and gotten a higher mark. But the trend, we can see by the line of best fit, as the hours of studies increases, your mark also increases, right? So there's a positive relationship. So it's more likely that you're going to get a higher mark if you study for more hours. You're going to use this example to complete exercise one, which is actually the scatter plot of the open activity, the Winter Olympics. So I gave you the scatter plot, the Winter Olympics, the year versus the number of medals. And you can complete exercise one, and we'll take it up in a bit. I know the question asks you for how many medals do you predict Canada should have won, right? We know how many they actually did win, but you're going to use your line of best fit to tell you how many they should have won, according to the graph. We already know how many we did win, but according to the graph and what you calculate, what would you expected them to win or predicted them to win? Okay, we're gonna take it out. So for part A, we want you to draw the line of best fit for your data. So this is the line of best fit I kind of drew, given the data set. And so what do you notice about the scatter plot and the line of best fit you drew? What do you notice about it?
There's a lot more under than
over.
There are more metals.
Pardon me?
Yeah, Canada
has
more metals, so I said...
Yeah, Canada had more metals, right? But does it pass by a lot of points?
No.
No? Is there just a few points above and below?
Yes.
Well, it looks like there's a lot above and below, right? Does it look like it represents the data well? As well as it did for the first graph?
No.
Which graph looks better? Which line of best fit represents better? The math test one, right? What do you guys suggest for using this? Instead of a line of best fit, do you guys suggest using anything else?
Yes.
What else do you think we could use? Instead of a line, does anybody have any other suggestions?
A curve.
Okay, you can see a pattern. What else could you use? Yeah? Instead of using a line of best fit, we could? Use a curve of best fit, right? So if I were to just, I might draw a curve, and it might, you know, it might represent the data better, right? But the data kind of fits this kind of pattern, don't you think? More than a line? So using your line of best fit, how many medals do you predict Canada should have won? How many did your line of best fit tell you? Mine's telling me something around, I'd say about 13-ish or something. 12? How much did yours tell you? Yeah?
9.
11.
7.
9. 9. 10. 7. And how many did they actually win?
26.
Now if we drew a curve of Vesta, do you think we would have gotten closer to 26?
Yeah.
Exactly, right? And this is another reason you can tell that this is a poor prediction. So you have to know that not all scatter plots will have a line of best fit that represents the data well. Like we can see here. The first graph, it did a really good job of predicting your mark. But the second graph, not so much. So some graphs might have a curve of best fit. Or no line at all. Because the points are too scattered and you can't put a line or a graph or anything. So line of best fit does not apply to all graphs, okay? Just remember that. That if you get a graph that you can't really draw a line of best fit to that doesn't represent it well, that's not your fault. It just might not be that there is a line of best fit. So that's the line of best fit. And now we're gonna move on to frequencies. So the frequency of an object in a data set is a count of how often it occurs in the data set. So how frequent does it happen? And the relative frequency of the object is the number of times it occurs in the data divided by the total number of objects that are in the data set. And this can be represented as a percent, a fraction, or a decimal. So we usually think of the mode as the most number of times an object appears in the data set, right? But it can also be the value with the highest frequency. So whichever object has the highest frequency, that's the mode of the data set. And another thing to note is that the sum of the relative frequencies of all the objects in the data set will be 1, or 100% if you're talking about percentages. So you should always remember that once you've done all the relative frequencies, they should all add up to 1 or 100%, depending on if you're doing it in decimals or fractions, or percentages, sorry. Okay, so for example, Mrs. Scott asked each of her students in her class how many siblings they had. And the following set of numbers you have are the answers that she got from her students. So we want to calculate the relative frequency of each number of siblings. So if you count it, how many numbers are in the data set?
27.
And we find that 5 people have 0 siblings, 15 people have 1 sibling, 4 people have 2 siblings, and 1 person has 3, 1 person has 4, and 1 person has 6 siblings. So what would you want to do to find out the relative frequency of 0 siblings? What would we do?
So we have to find out what one value would be. So for a percentage, so I did 100 divided by 27, which returned 3.703.
Okay.
And then I multiplied that by the number of times 0.
Okay, so how many times does 0 appear, guys?
Five.
5, right? And we have the relative frequency is the number of times it occurs in the data set divided by the total number of objects in the data set. So how many did it appear? 5. And how many are there in total? 27. So you take 5 divided by 27 and you get 18.5% or 0.185. So how about for one sibling? What's the relative frequency? Okay, that's the number of times it appears in the data set, right? 15 divided by the total number, which is? 27, right? And we get 55.6%. How about for two siblings? How many times does it occur in the data set?
4 times.
4 times, and 4 divided by 27 gives you? 14.8%, right? How about three siblings? How many people in her class have three siblings? Yeah? One. So we take 1, we divide it by 27, and we get?
3.7%.
And this is the same for four siblings, right? One person has four siblings. So that's also 3.7%. How about five siblings? How many people have five siblings? 0. So what's the relative frequency?
0.
So 0% of people have five siblings. And how about 6? One person has 6 siblings, and that gives you 3.7%, as we said before, right? And so by the relative frequencies, what is the mode of the data using the relative frequencies? 1. Why is it 1? Because the people with one sibling have the highest relative frequency. So the mode is one sibling. Okay, so in the past, relative frequencies of letters in the English language have been used to solve simple codes called substitution ciphers. And so in a substitution cipher, each letter in the message is encoded by a different one of the 26 letters to obtain a ciphertext. So maybe you're given a coded message where the letter E actually represents the letter X, or the letter A actually represents the letter T. So it's a jumbled up message. So people looking to crack the code would compare the letter frequencies of the ciphertext against the letter frequency of letters in normal English text. So they look at, in their coded message, how many times does the letter X appear? And you match that to the number in the regular English text. So by counting the number of each letter in various English texts, the following relative frequencies, from highest to lowest, of each letter were found. So the letter that most appears in the English language, in the English text, is not surprisingly the letter E. 12.7% of your text has E's in it. Next is 9% of T's, and 8% of A's, about 7.5% of O's, and continuing onwards up until Z, where you almost got like 0%, right? So they would make relative frequencies, right, of the letters that they had, and they think that, okay, well, if I have, like, you know, less than 1% of a letter, maybe that letter represents a Z. Or if I have, you know, 14% of a letter, maybe that letter represents E. Right? If X showed up the most in their text, they might have thought that X represents an E. So, as one of your exercises, you have a ciphertext. That is all a jumbled up message. And you're going to find the relative frequencies of each of the letters and use that compared to the relative frequencies we've given you, and you're going to decode the message.
I'm halfway done.
So you guys can go ahead and get started on that.
Before you start decoding your message and solving the puzzle, you first want to do the relative frequencies. A lot of you are getting confused as to, okay, well, I have a 2.5% and that closely matches an M. So whatever letter gave me a relative frequency of 2.5% must mean M. And that's not entirely true, right? This is generally, so we want you to use a little bit of common sense, a little bit of puzzle solving skills, right? First, fill out the chart, and maybe the one with the highest frequency, right, might be an E, because, you know, E is represented the highest. Guys, can you listen? So then, I don't think you're finished with puzzle, are you? No. So first, fill out the table, okay? So you can use a table, and a little bit of common sense. Okay, guys, we're going to take it up as a class. So, what did we find out as our very first letter that was a little bit of a giveaway? Yeah.
J is E.
J is E, and how did we get that?
It has the highest.
It has the highest frequency. J has the highest frequency in our code, and E has the highest frequency in our English text. And actually, they match up a little, right? 12.7 and 12.5. So we can replace all the J's in our code with E's. Okay, what was the next thing we found, guys?
Can I just say two because one, there's V and C is the
two are the two one-letter words, right? V and C are your the two one-letter words, right?
And V is closer to A, so
in letter frequency, right? A is higher in frequency than I,
so V is A.
So V is A. What's your other one-letter word?
C.
I.
And I, right?
Yeah.
So you replaced V with A and C with I. Because V had a higher frequency, and so did A. And then you replace C with I. So we're going to do that. Okay, how about what's next? I also gave a few of you hints on three-letter words. What are the two most popular three-letter words?
And
the, right? And we have a couple three-letter words. And we can see that a couple of those begin with A. So we can say that VGX replaces the word and, A-N-D, so we're going to replace G with M, and D with X. Okay, what next? The two-letter word, right? We have an I at the front. We think that it might be? It. So, that two-letter word is C-N, and we're going to replace N with T. Okay, and then we can see that we have a T-blank-E. For N-I-J. So we're going to replace I with H. So what do we know next? Well, we have a T space something. And the only word it could be is two for a two-letter word. And that is N-B. So we can replace B with O. Alrighty, what else can we do? Yeah? Yeah, we have E-N-O blank blank H. And that looks like enough. So we know that six-letter word is J-G-B-K-P-I, and we can say that K is Q and P is G. What do you? What about the O-N-G, blank O-N-G? What do we think that word is?
Song.
Song or?
Long.
Long?
And then G-I, can we get?
Well, okay, so we don't know that one quite well. So what about the first word? What do you think that word is?
Yes.
Oh, I know the last. So we can replace S with B. Okay, what else can we do?
Well, for O-N-G over there,
yeah?
Put an L in front of it.
So you think it's an L?
Yeah.
We're going to take a little risk and we're going to go with an L, okay?
What?
So we're going to replace O with L. Okay. So we have a little bit more. What do you think it is? We have L-E-V-E. What do we think it is?
Lever.
So we're going to replace E with R. What else do we think? Yeah? Okay, so maybe it's give me. So we're going to replace U with M. Give me a lever long enough and a something on something something. Okay, what else can we say? Now we're getting closer, yeah?
It's give me a lever long enough and a
fulcrum. Fulcrum? We think it's a fulcrum. Okay, so we're going to replace W with F and R with C. What else? We're getting really close.
Oh, the bottom one, you can see it's Archimedes.
It's Archimedes, the mathematician. We can replace M with S. Okay, what else? We have a few letters missing. Give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on.
With
like the very second last
word. Yeah.
World.
Yeah. World. Yeah. Right? Okay, so the last word can be world. The second last word. So we can replace H with W. Okay, so give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it. We can replace A with P. And I shall move the world. Archimedes. So the full message is, give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world. And this is quoted by Archimedes. So there, that is how people decode text. So this is the end of our lesson.